Sort of Remembers.
Hello and welcome to Andy Hamilton, Sort of Remembers. Now, you're probably wondering what to expect from this show. And for me, it's going to be a sort of nostalgic ramble down memory lane. That's what it's going to be like for me. For you, it's going to be a bit like visiting me in a home. So, here comes the first memory. I'm on a train to Devon with my daughter, and we get chatting to a lovely retired couple, both doctors, and they tell us about a colleague of theirs who was a brilliant surgeon, but a creature of habit. So every day he would arrive at the hospital at exactly the same time. He would go to his locker, always had the same locker. He would take out the key, unlock the locker, and he would take out of the locker a little black book, and he'd read it for about 30 seconds or so. Then he put the book back, and then he'd go through into the operating theatre, and he always had the same operating theatre, insisted on that. And then he performed countless operations, saving thousands of lives over 30, 35 years. And then, sadly, he passed away. And his colleagues asked his widow if they could have the key to this locker so that they could see what sort of pearl of wisdom was in the little black book. So she said yes. So they all gathered round the locker. Rather melancholy experience. They're all gathered round the locker, and one of his colleagues takes the key to the locker. He steps forward and unlocks the locker, opens the door, takes out the little black book and opens it at the first page. And there's just one sentence, and it reads, "The appendix is on the side nearest the window." That's why he insisted on the same operating theatre every time. He didn't want that window swap inside. So, I told you that story because my topic for today is the human body, which, as that story illustrates, can be a thing of mystery even to those who study it. Now, you're probably asking yourselves, you know, how can this Radio 4 joke monkey talk authoritatively about the human body? What does he know? Well, it's not something I usually brag about, but it just so happens that as well as being a writer and a performer, I also happen to be a fully qualified hypochondriac. Any hands up all the hypochondriacs in the audience, has I? Yeah, bloke putting his arm up going, "Oh, I still get that thing whenever I put my arm up, yeah. Well, I tell you what, if you are a hypochondriac, I've found this fantastic new service. It's called the Hypochondriac Helpline. Yeah, Hypochondriac Helpline. It's part of NHS Direct, I think. It's a brilliant service. Hypochondriac Helpline. What you do is you ring the number and you describe your symptoms down the phone, and then a voice at the other end says, "Yeah, I get that." A little bit of reassurance, a little bit of support. The human body. Okay, let's start with the basics. Fact number one about the human body: we've all got one. Okay, and our bodies tell a story, don't they? Because you probably know what they say. They say that your body is the map of your life, and like a map, as it gets older, somehow the bit that you need is always in the fold. It is though, isn't it? Have you noticed that? And the human body has changed within my lifetime. For example, if I'd been doing this show 50 years ago, this audience would have been much smaller. You know, on average, each of you would have been physically much smaller. People are bigger now, not just here, everywhere. But there is a paradox. Because although we are getting bigger, we're also getting weaker. Because we rely so much on automation now, we do so little manual work, we don't use our hands as much. So 300 years from now, it's likely that a human being will be 9 feet tall, but unable to open a jar of pickles. And it's not just our bodies that have changed, it's how we feel about them. Because we no longer just have a body, we also have a body image. Now, to a certain extent, you know, that's not new. It's human nature to crave a better physique. For instance, when I was little, I'd have liked a longer neck, or even a neck. But then as I grew older, I realised that being so short-necked had certain advantages. You know, I never have cold ears. And when I'm being annoying, I'm very hard to strangle. Similarly, when I was little, I didn't want to be. You know, I was very aware that as people constantly used to say, I was small for my age. Or as I prefer to call it, old for my size. So of course I dreamt of being taller. What small boy doesn't, you know? I dreamt of being able to star at basketball and reach pornography and newsagents. But adulthood brings perspective. And now, every time I get on a plane, find my seat and see the legroom, I thank God that I am small. You know? Same at the theatre. Because people may have got bigger, but the seating hasn't, has it? No, the only time as an adult that I've ever genuinely minded being small was just once in the late 1990s. I'm sitting in a tea shop with the late, great Linda Smith in Brighton. So Linda and I are drinking our tea, and suddenly there's a lot of shouting. And an excited crowd is gathering outside on the pavement. So we dash outside, and Linda is looking over the crowds. She's looking over the crowds, and suddenly she shouts, "Oh, wow, it's Nelson Mandela." Only I can't see over the people's heads. And by the time I get a sight line, Mandela's gone. And that is the only time in my life that I've ever had any regrets about my height, the day I was too short to see Nelson Mandela. Of course, if Linda had been a true friend, she'd have picked me up. But there you go. I remember doing a news quiz with her once, and there was a story that said short men were more faithful husbands. But Linda maintained that that was just because they weren't tall enough to go, "Oh, look, there's another woman over there." So I've been trying to work out when our attitudes started to change. When did people change from accepting the body they've been born with to regarding it as just a starting point? You know, an initial suggestion from Mother Nature. You know, something to reconstruct and redesign and write stuff on, you know. I mean, to be fair, this change in attitude probably has made people's bodies more attractive. It's certainly made them a more interesting read. You see, when I was a kid, the only people who had tattoos were criminals and Popeye. Yuck, I am what I am. See, I love Popeye, even though it was just a trick to make me eat spinach, which, as any child knows, is the gateway vegetable for broccoli. Sorry, I got distracted by broccoli. So when did our attitudes to our bodies change? Well, I reckon it started sometime around 1983. You know, and it was around that time that outwardly sane people started to say that after work, they were going down the gym. Yeah, down the gym. That's basically doing extra PE. voluntarily. Yeah, some people even pay other people to be their personal PE teacher, don't they? Because that's basically what a personal trainer is, isn't it? It's just a slightly nicer version of that sadistic git who used to chuck the medicine ball at you. Actually, do they still have medicine balls? You know, those huge, heavy balls? I was a very weedy child, and I tried to catch a medicine ball once. It was basically like stepping in front of a train. I suppose, looking back, mankind was doomed to be vain about his body the moment he invented the mirror. You know, with glass, that kind of mirror. Because I presume that prehistoric man must have spent 99% of his life with no idea what he looked like. You know, if prehistoric man was going out clubbing and he wanted to check out how he looked, he'd have had to run to the nearest pond and just hope there wasn't a breeze. Yeah. And he must have been hugely reliant on the honesty of his friends, wasn't he? "This hat I've made out of dead crow, it's not too much, is it? Does it make my forehead look big?" That's my rendition of Neanderthal Man. Sounded a bit like Ray Winston having a bad day. Yep, this exercise craze is just the latest installment in man's desperation to look beautiful. And of course, if you find that exercise can't give you the body you want, you can always pay a stranger to come at you with a knife. Pay him to whittle off any bits that are too big or enlarge bits that aren't big enough, usually by nicking a bit from your ass. Now, I work in TV a lot, so I encounter quite a few people whose bodies are work in progress, shall we say. You know, quite a few people who, for some reason, now look permanently surprised or whose lips appear to have been attacked by hornets. Perhaps I'm being unfair. You know, I mean, perhaps I'm being very unfair. Who knows? Perhaps they just achieve that look down the gym. You know, building up the core strength in their lip muscles. Picking up medicine balls with their mouth. Of course, the surest way to keep your body attractive is not to abuse it or damage it. Now, I've been extremely lucky, touch wood, because in 63 years, I've only ever broken one bone. I broke it playing football. Top of my arm there. And unfortunately, I complicated the fracture by displacing it, so they had to reset the bone. So I'm lying there in the bones unit, and the doctor is looking at the x-ray, and it's a rather complicated fracture, and he's going, tricky. And he turns to, there's a small nurse next to the bed. He says, yes, nurse, I think I'm going to need George for this one. Could you go fetch George? So she beetles off to fetch this George. And the doctor and I have a little chat for a couple of minutes. And then all of a sudden, everything goes black. And I think, oh, great, I'm going into a coma. But no, the reason everything's gone so dark is that George is filling the doorway. George is the biggest, squarest human being I've ever seen. He's an orderly, all right, but he is massive. So the doctor calls him and says, George, come in. This is Mr. Hamilton. He's a comedy writer, so we better be careful what we say, or he might write a skit about us. And George goes, So then the doctor, he gets the x-ray, and he holds it up to the light again, and he says, right, so it's down, then left, then up, and then across. Okay, all right, now listen up, George. I need you to take hold of the ends of the fingers of Mr. Hamilton's right hand, and when I say pull, pull, and I don't need too much this time. What are the words this time doing on the end of that sentence? Where's the last patient George helped out with, you know? I'm picturing a ward full of Venus de Milo lookalikes. Anyway, it was all right. As you can see, George didn't pull my arm off. Although that would make a great ending to that anecdote, wouldn't it? Actually, thinking about it, perhaps the healthiest attitude to the human body is that of doctors. Because to them, the body's just a place of work, you know. So they develop this dispassionate attitude, and sometimes that can get expressed through earthy gallows humour. Now, when I was at university, a lot of my friends were medical students, and they liked to work hard and play hard, and they told me this story about a high-spirited medical student who went to a pathology lab and stole a penis. Yeah, a specimen, not a working one, obviously. And he was going to a party. So he somehow attached this specimen penis to the outside of his trouser zip. And he arrived at the party with this penis apparently just hanging out on show. And the hostess opened the door and shrieked, "Oh, my God!" And he looked down and went, "Oh, God, oh, sorry about that," and produced the penknife and cut it off. Yeah. At which point she fainted. Now, the poor taste is what's shocking about that story, isn't it? No, what's shocking is that person is now a doctor. Yeah, almost certainly. Yeah, he could be the consultant you're seeing tomorrow. Yeah. Or maybe even your anaesthetist, yeah. There's a woman down here, she's gone completely white. I'm so sorry. up and down the country tomorrow. Hospital waiting rooms will be strangely empty. Doctor's saying, it's very odd. No Radio 4 listeners have turned up for their appointments. The no-nonsense approach of some doctors was a thing I encountered shortly after I'd begun at college. And I went to see the GP that I'd been allocated by the university, who was an octogenarian, and then some, and very old school in his style, quite posh. And he said, what's the problem? And I said, well, I got hit by a football quite hard, and as a result, I've got a swollen testicle. He said, what? I said, I've got a swollen testicle. And he said, well, leave it alone. And I said, what? He said, stop playing with it, leave it alone. I said, I haven't been playing with it. Then he said, take up boxing. I said, pardon? He said, take up boxing. Good for young men's minds and bodies. Now, I think the statistics suggest he was wrong about it. But talking to other students who were also his patients, it turned out that this was his suggested treatment for everything. Yeah. Double vision, take up boxing. He probably thought gun shields should have been available on the NHS. Anyway, luckily I didn't have any other medical problems while I was at uni, so I never had to go see him again. Not that I would have done. But listen, in fairness, I'm sure he was loved, you know, by his regular patients with their flat noses and cauliflower ears. And as we grow older, we begin to realise that our body is just a way of getting from A to B, isn't it? It's a conveyance. A vehicle. And the vehicle's driver is the brain. Now, there are many mysteries about the brain. And perhaps the biggest mystery about your brain is that it's supposed to be on your side, isn't it? There used to be a wonderful running joke in The Simpsons where in moments of crisis, Homer Simpson would argue with his brain, which the brain would appear in a thought bubble above his head. And I can remember one brilliant exchange where he said, all right, brain, you don't like me and I don't like you. And that feels like my life in a nutshell, you know, because there have been countless occasions where my brain has willfully humiliated me. When I was 22, I just started writing. I was on a radio show called Weekending, and Thursday was the big writing day, and I had to write very fast under a lot of pressure. And for some reason, I got into this involuntary mental routine whereby every Thursday morning, as I went in on the tube, as the train approached Green Park Station, I'd start to feel nauseous. And at Green Park, the doors would open, I'd leap off the train, throw up on my platform, and then jump back on again. Yeah, I felt like one of Pavlov's dogs, you know, because this happened every Thursday morning for months, which was a problem. But the bigger problem was that I was always travelling in at the same time, on the same train. So it was always the same faces, the same fellow travellers. And it got to the stage that as I boarded the train at Brixton, I could see those faces all thinking, oh no, it's Green Park, man. And it's a Thursday. Now, I don't know why my brain did that to me. It's done it a few times in my life, actually. Made me so nervous that I've thrown up. There's a lady down here just moving her handbag. Yep. The brain is capable of so much. It can control and coordinate a million reflexes and actions. It can in a split second generate thousands of spontaneous connections that can spawn thoughts of immense originality, even genius. But the thing the human brain does best of all is worry. Because worrying, that's the brain's default setting. And it gets worse. As you get older, as your body ages, your brain finds more things to worry about. Once I was briefing a veteran actor about his character's plotline, and I said, yeah, your character started to forget things, and because he's forgetting stuff, he's worried that he might be developing Asperger's. And he looked at me and said, do you mean Alzheimer's? And I went, oh, yeah, sorry, Alzheimer's. And he said, you forgot the name of Alzheimer's, which, granted, you know, could be a bit ominous. similarly, I was chatting once with a friend, and we were both saying how bad our memories were getting. And she said, "I've heard ginkgo is very good for your memory." And I said, "Oh, really? What is ginkgo?" She said, "Oh, well, I think it's a root, isn't it, or something like that." I said, "Well, where can you buy ginkgo?" She said, "Well, I think you can get it in health food shops or in chemists." And then suddenly she went, "Oh!" I said, "What?" She said, "We had this conversation 2 weeks ago." We had forgotten the conversation about forgetting things. And to a person of a certain age, that can be disturbing. And yet, I read a study a while back where they monitored a group of teenagers and a group of retired people and discovered that the teenagers forgot just as many things as the older people, but they didn't attribute any significance to it. And it's true, isn't it? Many of you will have had dealings with teenagers. They're going out the door and you say, "You got your keys?" And they go, "Oh, no." Well, where are they? Don't know. Must have left them somewhere. "Can I borrow yours?" Can I borrow your Oyster card? Your phone and your trousers. See, teenagers don't torment themselves over memory loss because their brain isn't panicking about that yet. You know, it's too busy thinking about sex. Every 14 seconds, you know that? Teenagers think about sex every 40. It's a miracle they pass any exams, to be honest. There's no denying that the brain's an extraordinary biological computer, but it's a computer that can get bogged down on the data. A friend of mine was sitting a course once to become a TV and film continuity PA, and all the students had to watch the same bit of film twice over, but the second time there were subtle changes that they had to spot. So the tutor asked her what the differences were that she'd spotted in the second version, and she said, "Well, in the second version he picked up the red mug, whereas in the first version he picked up the blue mug." And she said, "In the second version his hair was parted on the left, but in the first version it was parted on the right," and so on and so forth. She'd spotted 19 differences. And the tutor said, that's not bad. "Let's just watch the second version again, shall we?" And she watched it again. And after about 30 seconds, she realized that she'd missed one difference, which was that in the second version, a man had walked slowly across the back of the room wearing a gas mask. Yes, it's so easily done, isn't it? Because your brain is so busy watching all the details, it misses the bigger picture. You know, our brains are designed like that. It's why during the US election, the voters got bogged down on the minutiae of Donald Trump's daily tweets and missed the fact that he's mad. Where was I? Oh, yeah. The mysteries of the human brain. Though, of course, it's not just the brain. There are many, many mysteries about the human body. Why are male genitalia so vulnerably external? Why is knowing that the alarm clock is about to go off the surest way to fall asleep? Why, during childbirth, do women make so much fuss? Just a joke. It's all right. It's just a joke. Although there is a bloke down here nodding quietly. No, it's just a joke. I was there for when our children was born. I've seen how painful it can be, especially if your husband's hogging the gas and air. No, it's a joke as well. I didn't hog the gas and air. All right. While my wife was giving birth. You know, I let her have a go. And then, of course, there's the biggest mystery of all, which is why does the human body wear out? Because it does. And as it wears out, as it ages, weird stuff starts to happen, doesn't it? If you're a man, hair starts sprouting out of your ears and nostrils like your upholstery has gone. Women's thermostats develop a sense of humour. It's called getting older, and it's unavoidable. Or is it? Now, a few years ago, I made a show called It's Only a Theory with Reginald D. Hunter. And on that show, we had a gerontologist. A gerontology is the study of aging. And he predicted that the first 1,000-year-old person has already been born. might even be one of you, because his argument was that in the next few decades, medical technologies will advance at such a rate that people will be able to extend their lives in good health almost indefinitely. And he felt that very soon the breakthroughs would come, and that mean we'd all be living for 500, 600 years. And I said, that's really exciting. What age would you have to be now to have your life massively extended by these breakthroughs? And he looked at me and he said, how old are you? And I said, 59. And he said, I think you just missed the cut. But he felt sure that the day was not long off when aging could be prevented and human beings would be able to live forever. Hands up, everyone who'd like to live forever. Hands up. Oh, no hands. That's interesting. All right, let me rephrase the question. Do you want to die? Yeah. Also no hands. That's a bit of a contradiction there, isn't it? Well, you see, when push comes to shove, it's a difficult call, isn't it? I remember I worked in an office where in the kitchen, the cupboard was full of mugs, and there was one mug I used to like to use to make my tea, because it had a little motto written on it, which said, I like life, it's something to do. And that's right, isn't it? I mean, being dead must be quite dull. So if you could postpone it indefinitely, why wouldn't you, you know? Though, of course, for most of you listening at home, I don't suppose you'll have to grapple with that decision, because I suspect that most of you will have missed the cut as well. So that's right, Andy, always a great way to end a show. Confront the audience with their own mortality. You couldn't just do a song and get off, could you? Well, listeners, my trip down my body-related memory lane has drawn to a close. Till the next time, whenever that is. God, I should be able to remember that. That is a bit... Oh, no, I'm feeling nauseous. Okay. Stand well back. Move that handbag. And goodbye.
Andy Hamilton Sort of Remembers was written and performed by Andy Hamilton. The producer was Claire Jones. It was a BBC Studios production.